How was your piss?
Yo, what's going on, everyone? Welcome to another edition of the Streamcast. I'm Blackamora. I'm joined by Hallie.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Who is looking very sharp today? It's been hooked up by our friends over at Logitech. Thank you so much for the gifts. There are more coming. I've got mine.
Thank you very much, Logitech.
Yeah. Shall we get into this Ragnarok review?
Where
would you like to begin? Because I've got several notes, and I mean, this can go on for a while. But yes.
I think we should start with if someone maybe has like been isekai'd and just turned back up. What is God of War Ragnarok?
Sure.
Who's it by?
So God of War Ragnarok is the very anticipated sequel to God of War, released in 2018, developed by Sony Santa Monica and published by Sony PlayStation. Directed by Eric Williams, who took the reins from Corey Barlog, who directed the 2018 game, as well as God of War 2, two of my favorite games in the entire franchise. And you kind of just pick up right after you left off with the 2018 game. So Kratos has, you know, traveled to Scandinavia, and he's in the realm of these Norse gods. Following on the destruction he left in Greece with the Greek gods, he's now trying to start his life again. He's got a son. And with the journey 2018 game, you see yourself and the sun grow together. You get stronger, you get closer, and you bond based on the death of Kratos' wife and Atreus' mother. You find out.
Fate spoilers!
Spoilers, you find out Atreus is Loki, and Ragnarok is all about exploring that. Atreus knows he's got giants in him, so he wants to find out how he fits into the world, the universe, the lifespan of the giants. With Thor being their natural enemy, having wiped out almost all of them. So in Ragnarok, you just start off at the start of Ragnarok, pretty much. Freya's chasing you. I really liked how the game started because you got a really cool sled scene. I think that's how a lot of games should start off. You just put your best foot forward.
And from there, it's led to victory.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I got a lot of notes that will, I guess, just follow the main story and kind of hit points there. So if there's anything you want to say, like, in general, or if you want to just go off what I say, I mean, let me know.
Yeah, I think what the game is, then cons, and then pros, so we leave on, like, a happier kind of bright note.
Okay. Well, there are a lot of pros. I really like a lot of what this game tried to deliver. I think the new characters that they added really fleshed out the franchise a lot more, with Odin and Thor primarily being your main antagonists for the game. Odin being the slick and suave mafioso was a really nice touch. He always seemed like he had everything under control. Thor was the heavy hitter. And I saw a lot of similarities in a lot of pairings. So with Kratos and Atreus being, I guess, type A, you see with Sindri and Brock, even though they were brothers, you saw Brock following more Kratos type energy and Sindri following the Atreus archetype. With Odin and Thor, that's a much more aggressive version of Kratos and Atreus, because you will hear throughout the game Odin just berate Thor and just order him about like a weapon. It has a pretty nice payoff at the end of the game that we are going to get into, because this is a spoiler cast.
I can only apologize. I'm gonna say some stuff.
It was completely frustrating to have Kratos and Tyr constantly belittling Atreus. Just treating him as when like just treating him as if he's wrong and not listening to him, not trying to see, hey, how about this point of view? But just a shutdown. I know that's the way it is with, you know, parents and children a lot of the time, but it was annoying to live through that in a game.
I think it's like, you know, that trope of like, you know, siblings hating each other, like that we see in like 99% media.
Yeah.
It's a trope that's like, it doesn't need to be here anymore. Like, if you have siblings, that's not how that relationship is. It's not all hunky-dory, but it's complicated because it's a human relationship, right?
Yeah.
And like, I think when the game leans on tropes, it's when it's at the weakest, and this is definitely a trope that they repeat kind of almost at the end of every single act. It was, now we don't listen to Atreus again.
Mm.
And then we're going to have the payoff be the kickoff to the next arc, or the next act, or the next line of the story, or the next story beat. And I think around like the second time, you can kind of start to see that repeating.
Yeah.
I definitely kind of had like almost it's time. Like you turn back to you go back to Brockett's injured house and you'd be like, oh yeah, this is what we're gonna do now.
I get what you mean with the tropes, and it did feel like potentially the story was just being stalled because not enough has been done with the other elements for the story to progress, which kind of felt like a drag. And I think it was one of my biggest worries going into the game. You're implying that this entire saga is going to be wrapped up in this game. There's several questions. Are you going to be able to answer them? That was a lot of, you know, questions that I was thinking. There were some points where it felt like, hold on, what are we doing here? Because it just feels like we're not seriously advancing the story, we're just exploring, which isn't necessarily a problem, but I was sold in this game as a story as well as a game, and there were times where I felt like that wasn't being fulfilled.
This is kind of a pro, and I feel like I'm going to circle back to this point later. The thing with the exploration and like the kind of the timeline of things is it's quite fluid. I noticed this with your stream of it. I did things in such a different order that I had Freya with me at parts where you didn't, and vice versa.
Hmm.
And that is very cool because that impacted the conversations and the building of the story and the storytelling between Ymir and your companion and you in those moments. That is cool. That is super cool. That said, though, if you main like this story, you're missing so much exposition, like so much exposition, that it at times feels like if you aren't doing side quests, you're not playing the whole game. And again, this is something I noticed with your playthrough, because time constraints is a real thing. Like it's like watching a stream for 4 hours is hard for you to be like, I'm going to do every side quest because you're going to be streaming that game till the end of time, right?
Yeah.
And like, it's not really fair on you, and it's not really fair on the expecting people to kind of constantly be with you on that, and that changes your experience too with the game and kind of like how you interacted with the story. That said, though, goddamn those side quests, I love them. my issue, though, is I think there were certain areas and certain sections that felt like I was just running around the houses. Like, it's not the worst thing. It's not the worst thing in the game. I'm nitpicking. I'm absolutely looking for something to nitpick because I'm going to sound quite unbiased. Like, I'm going to sound quite biased when we get to the positives. but it is genuinely a game that deserves the laurels and the kind of respect that it gets because of how much it did well and the things it did well being excellent. Yeah, that's me.
Yeah, you make very good points. Kind of didn't even register the fact that you would have different dialogue options, or you would have different dialogue cutscenes play out depending on whether you have Atreus or Freya with you as your partner, I guess. And that's really cool because they've had to reshoot lines. They've had to essentially do everything twice for those to work and be seamless and make sense. I mean, they could have very easily locked off Freya if they wanted you to play as Atreus for certain points, whether you're a Midgard or, you know, the other way around if you're in Vanaheim. But they've done it so that you get that freedom, you get that flexibility. That's really cool. And it works either way, as you know, whether you leave the side quest for post-game content or whether you do it as you're doing it, as you are playing the main game. I think you don't lose either way in that regard. And yeah, that's a very thoughtful implementation. A con is Freya's sigil magic, because I hated it. I hated the sigil magic so much. I think it just didn't work for my playstyle. But I feel just watching, you know, tutorials about it and just seeing how this is how you're meant to use it, I could just see I'm not gonna like this. Mm-hmm. And I didn't. I really hated it. I think it really made puzzles unenjoyable. It was fine for a lot of the time, like in terms of a mechanical experience, but I just think that's not the type of game mechanic that I prefer. So that dampened my experience. Personally, I can get sucked, but I don't think I can objectively say this was terrible.
You know? Not bad, just not for me.
Yeah, yeah. How did you feel about the sigil magic?
I have a very different playstyle to you. And this is, again, something I found so fascinating. Because I tried out sigil magic. I really gave it, like, a college try. I was like, it's a new toy. I want to put it through its paces, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's... I don't like stall play. Like, I like kind of very fast pace. I was like, build up stun. That was the build I was kind of going for the whole game.
Right.
Like, I definitely had a different approach to how I fought bosses and stuff. And trying to add sigil magic in changed kind of everything, because it was like, I do no damage because none of my stuff is elemental.
Yeah.
And like, I really... Yeah. Like, I tried to make like an elemental build afterwards. Like when I started after you finished it, and I was like, oh, I really want to play again, right? So I was like, oh, I'm gonna play again, but like let me do something a bit different, right? So I made like a elemental build with my armor, with like the sockets and everything else. I was like, now sigil magic is going to sink, it's going to be broken, I'm going to do mad damage. And for the most part, I was doing like mad damage. Mm-hmm. I just really didn't enjoy playing like that. And that's on me. Like, that's not my preferred style. Like, you've seen me play like Dead Cells and stuff. Like, I'm very much quick, roll around, right? Like, that's way more fun to me than sit back, build up tons of damage. Ooh, when that next arrow comes.
Yeah, I don't think that's even a fault of yours. I think that's just the playstyle that you prefer. And I think I'm much more in that camp. Yeah, I see that you're very much like in and out. You just want to get the high damage in and fast. I'm similar. I don't like setup plays. I don't like, okay, I've done this, so then in two turns, this was going to do mad damage to you. I'd rather just one-shot you. So it doesn't work for me. I much prefer
you. You've stepped in my trap card.
Right. No. No, I think that's why a lot of turn-based games literally do turn me off, because I'm not into that. I like a lot more real-time action, fast-paced stuff. So I went with the sound arrows. I much prefer those, because I don't believe you should be playing without, you know, your sidekick, I guess. But yeah, definitely spam the hell out of those sound arrows. Just the sigil stuff I used when I had to for puzzles, and that's the best thing I could say about it. Didn't enjoy it.
This is going to sound controversial. the chains I only used when I had to.
Oh, okay. We're gonna get. I was gonna ask you this later, but actually, we can get into it now.
That the just like just as a before people crucify me. I don't think the chains are bad. I just think they're ineffective. And I don't know if it's a kind of by design thing, because there was you have a toolkit, right? There's there's three, we're doing spoilers. There's three main weapons.
Yeah.
I was like, who? There's three main weapons, so they have to make your weapons enjoyable to use, and they have to feel empowering, especially when you're playing at higher difficulties. You played like Give Me God of War, right? And that's bananas. Like I was playing it at normal, and for the most part, I didn't ever struggle. Like I definitely struggled with some of the bosses and stuff, but like it wasn't because I felt like the game wasn't letting me do damage, or the bosses were like it wasn't Monster Hunter. Like I never felt that way either. Although watching Give Me God of War, I'm glad I'm not doing this.
that has Monster Hunter vibes.
And I feel like if I was playing that difficulty and I was using the chains, I would have a way angrier kind of stance on the chains than I already do.
Especially
because we didn't use elemental damage, and that's a weapon that stacks elemental damage. It's not bad, it's just not for me.
Yeah. I would say that the blades were the worst weapon in the game. I mean, we're only talking about three, so it's not much of a statement, but I do think that the axe and the spear were much better weapons. They had much more utility. They felt like they fit the game better. And when you consider that the blades were brought in from a completely different game engine for a different style of play, it makes sense. It should feel outdated. They're the classics, but they don't do the same amount of work anymore. And it's just the way it is. I use the blades for crowd control, so when I had more than two enemies, I use the blades. But the axe was always my favorite weapon. I just love the weight to it. It felt heavy. It felt like it did a lot of damage. And I could time out the attacks better. I could... how do I say this? I could work out the enemy's rhythm better with the axe, because the slower swing kind of gave me a lot of time to work with. Whereas the blades, they were lighter, so they were quicker. So I'm just spamming and getting caught out.
I'm just slapping this dude with these sashes. I'm doing nothing.
Yeah, they do a lot less damage too. Yeah. Ugh. But when it comes to weapons, what were your favorite weapon to use in the game?
Axe, spear, chains. Those were for me.
In that same.
Yeah. The axe just there was something very cathartic about both the ranged nature of the axe, even over the spear. Like the spear's great. Like it's such a nice addition. But the axe, throwing it, freezing an enemy, and having like them running over and just haymakering this thing into oblivion. Delicious. Great. No notes. 10 out of 10, right? It's like, it's not, again, I'm not calling these chains bad. They just don't fit my style. And that's fine. I think the whole game kind of represents the sun setting. And the chains being a constant reminder of that sunset is quite interesting. I just never really thought about it in that way either, you know?
That's a good point, actually. That is a very good point. Yeah, I did not like the blades. Before we get on with the rest of the podcast, I'd just like to give a special shout out to Spilt Milk Studios for their support over on Patreon. To find out how you can get a shout out just like them, make sure to go to patreon.com/streamcast for more. So, in terms of... Okay, if we're talking about cons, I've got some more, actually.
And another thing.
One more thing. So, the small enemies, and the nest situation, I think, were the worst type of enemies in the game. I don't think they were bad. I just hated them. Enemies that are too small to hit just piss me off anyway. Because I have to like be even more precise. And the nest situation I hated because it reminds me of an earlier game, God of War Ascension. And those were rife. Like, there were so many enemies that had the nest situation. If you didn't destroy the nest, enemies would just keep coming. Ascension was an average game. I'm happy to say that. It wasn't a great game. I think they know that, which is why they went in this direction. So I don't know why they came back with that element from that game. I thought it was a weird choice. Didn't enjoy it. I stand by it. I think that they were bad. I just didn't like it. I don't know how you felt about it, because I didn't watch you play the game.
I think they were dialed up in frustration by a country mile at your difficulty. At normal, they're not great, but they're more of an annoyance than they are like any. They're never a threat. If you kind of keep on attention and kind of with the arrows and everything else, you're fine. You just have to find the nest and then just wail away, right? Don't have that luxury at high difficulties and having a lot of small enemies darting around all over the place. I was like, I don't know how I could see it on your face, the frustration. But I was sitting there and I was like, this doesn't feel well optimized. Because like the timing and the damage negation and everything else between normal and Gimme God of War is so different. And there is no balance to kind of give you a chance to kind of like keep yourself alive. And it's so easy to wipe and then have to redo that. And it's so easy to then wipe again and kind of ad nauseum keep doing that time and time again. It's like, it didn't have to be like this. Like, at no point did this enemy or this have to be like this. I don't think I saw a point in the game where those nest enemies made a tangible difference in the plus category for me. Like, I never felt like this enemy has made this section better for being.
Yeah.
Like, they could have put Wolves or anything else as a challenge in that section, and it would have been just maybe more fun because there was less frustration. That was the moment where I was like, fine, chains, I'll use them.
Yeah, that's a perfect situation for the blades. The crowd control element, like I said before, I felt called for the blades, whereas an axe or the spear called for one-on-one encounters. Yeah, the blades did their work when it came to those caves, but as you said, I don't think they made the game better. And then at that point, you're like, okay, why is it here?
There is definitely a reason to kind of like have a wide variety of enemies. Sure. Like God of War 2018 definitely suffered from, by the first like quarter of the game, you've seen like 90% of the enemies, right? Except for the big set pieces. You'd seen most of the enemies. And like you just see different variations of them after that. Having a new kind of threat or a new thing is an easy way to kind of get you engaged and kind of realize like, oh, this is a new biome. This is a new thing. This is the new way that I have to apply my toolkit. That's great. And even in this game, those enemies are making you think about the situation differently, and that's good, right?
Yeah.
It's just, if that good is outweighed by how frustrating the enemy is, then there's a balance that needs to be adjusted, right? It's not that they shouldn't be there. It's just either give us an ability to kind of make managing them better and less frustrating, or make them do less damage, right? Because, they're doing mad damage for what they were.
Yeah. Again, it's just a balancing thing, as you said. It's just... It feels like the game was designed to be played at, you know, balanced or the level just above it. So when you do come across enemies on the hardest difficulty and they've just cranked up the damage output, then it's kind of like, okay, well, this feels a bit cheap. And maybe that's on us for expecting all of that, because they've done a lot of stuff elsewhere in the game, as we've said, with the alternate dialogue with Atreus, Freya, fleshing out all of the side quests, fleshing out all of the secondary and even tertiary characters. There's a lot that they have done to service the player, but I guess it comes at a cost, I feel.
Absolutely. There's always going to be like a cost to things, right? If you want to deliver things with any sort of weight or any sort of not even just like emotional weight, but like cathartic weight to the gameplay itself, there's going to be a cost somewhere down the line. Like with infinite time and infinite resources, you can make a game that is like functionally perfect.
Yeah,
but you don't. So you have to you have to do things like this where you fill in a gap with these enemies to kind of stall or to build that kind of frustration or to kind of build a use for the tool that you made. And I get it. Totally fine. It's just I'm finding it hard to be mean about this game.
All right. On that note, let's get into the positives. Let's get into the pros of this game. Hassan, I'll have you open up, actually.
I love this story. Like, the story and how the story is delivered. I think the thing that we talked about the most, kind of, like, outside of streams and just kind of, like, WhatsApp and whatnot, is the story and the side quests. Oh. Oh, boy, do I love when a game goes, here's a sandbox.
Mm-hmm.
Go do what you want. And then okay. Doesn't tell you there's a thing here until you've kind of explored a bit. And then there's like, oh, there's a marker here now. So you can come back to it if you leave, right? That's engaging because I'm like, I'm not ticking things off a box. I'm exploring while it's alive.
Mm-hmm.
And you had some issues with Vanaheim, but I think Vanaheim is the most... Is the most kind of accurate depiction of that ethos of like kind of this is the world you're in.
Mm.
Do you want to go down the river? Do you want to go up onto that cliff and then explore the cliff? And that cliff has all these other major exploration points around there that you can go and fight some baddies or hide from a dragon or ooh, look, there's a thunderbolt. There's all these things you can kind of do at your own leisure.
Mm.
And there's consequences to that, and there's impact to that, because say you go and you find the Berserker.
Mm-hmm.
You defeat them, you unlock something that can then actively change the rest of your gameplay because it impacts how you play, because it improves your weapons or gives you like a boost that's going to be tangibly make your game easier, right?
Yeah.
Like that, that's great. Like, we were talking about my con. I'm gonna one last con. I hate collectathon things in games, and like it's one of the reasons why I don't for the most part platinum stuff. It's if you tell me collect 50 crows, I'm not doing that. Like
yeah,
but if you tell me that there's these 8 challenges in the world. You go fight them, they're going to be hard, they're going to be their own thing, they're going to challenge you. I'm going to go do those things. And then I get rewarded for it at the end, even better. I would have done a lot of the optional mini-bosses just because they were optional mini-bosses, but then having the flames or the gale or whatever other like upgrades, like the hell drogas, so much fun. So good, and they were so well crafted, and they, unlike the berserkers, felt balanced. Like I felt like the berserkers got cheap. Like I didn't finish all the berserkers. Like that's another thing, right? I was like, I don't know if you've done it yet. There's a berserker that is after a point they start like doubling up, and it was one where I was fighting two of them, and one of them was poisoning me, and I nearly threw my controller out the window. I was so angry.
Oh my god, I'm not there yet. I didn't know they double up on you.
They double up on you. And it's hell. Like, I spent like 6 hours or something just throwing my head against this wall, this specific brick wall, because I would, and this is a testament to how good this game is. I did this because I didn't want to finish the game and have it be over. I was like, I love this game and I want to do this. And to do and expand that joy, I'm going to do this thing that I hate. Like, I hate this. This is awful. Mm. And again, it isn't awful. It's just frustrating.
Yeah, it's not enjoyable.
And if a game isn't enjoyable, then what is why are we here, right? Like, the core principle should be the story moves you, a game you enjoy. If the story isn't moving you, what is the story doing? And moving isn't make happy, right? Like, that's a if a story is like a tragedy, it should make you sad. If a story is a romance, you should feel love in the story, right? You should feel something from that piece of art. And a game should absolutely be fun to play.
Yep.
And those bosses were not fun for me. Like, they... Yeah, that was the one where I was like, I'm not doing this anymore because I respect my sanity enough. Like, I can walk away from it.
Yeah, no, I hear that. Oh, I'm not looking forward to that then. I have more pros that do link with the story more. So Loki showing his teen angst with his know-it-all attitude. I thought that was very entertaining. There was a part where Loki thought he was going to be able to trick Odin. And I was just like, come on, man. Who are you kidding here? You really believe that?
It's his literal... It's his whole bag. you raise them stories about how he tricked people and things.
Uh-huh. Like, oh, I'm going to pretend to work for him while actually working for him. I don't think he thought this one through, mate. Come on.
I mean...
Yeah.
It was a giant mistake.
Look like what you did there. But that was interesting because for me, I was debating whether it was fooling himself or whether he actually believed he could fool Odin. But regardless, he was kind of playing into fate's hands there by actually doing what he was prophesized to do. And I won't lie, it was fun playing this Atreus because I feel he gave a different kind of power to Kratos. He was quicker, he was nimble, he was agile. And it didn't feel cheap playing as Atreus, which was a fear as soon as I realized, oh, we're playing as this guy now. Okay, well, he's always been weak. So am I just going to be a wimp who, you know, needs help? But he's done a pretty good job of making him feel as useful, if not even more useful than Kratos. Mm. I felt he actually played a little bit smoother.
He was strong in his own way, and that is... such a lauded thing. Like, that is such a thing that we need to kind of give them praise for. Oh,
100%.
Because, like, they could have just made him like a carbon copy, right, just with arrows instead, but he plays so differently.
Yeah,
chef kiss. There's, I think, one of my favorite scenes of the game, like, hands down, is the moment where he goes to punch through a treasure box. And yeah. It is such, because, like, it was a moment like so rife with kind of sadness and angst and like confusion and like these growing kind of like nagging worries and kind of like anxieties. And it was just such a pure moment of joy. I was like, oh, I think that's when I was like, this game's got me. I'm in. I'm 100% in.
What I really enjoyed about that is I was thinking that when he was approaching the treasure chest, I wonder if he's going to try and open it the way Kratos does. And before I've even completed my thought, he's just punched the thing. I like how they've added that kind of real-life-ism to the game. Mm. He's seen his dad do it countless times. Of course he's going to try and do that before trying to open it any other way.
Mm.
And I appreciate them for going through that effort.
There's so much interplay in this game of like, how do we choose and how do we live with our own agency?
Yeah,
and how do we let go and kind of trust others? The way that kind of the game, like, it's this meld between like a sunset and like a sunrise, and it is, for the most part, it almost feels like, a lot of the game feels like you're marching towards the funeral, right? Like, you spend the vast majority of the game being like, at some point we're gonna die. Like, and that is, and they do it in a way that's like really respects death without it being morose. And that's a hard line. Like, that's a hard line to write on.
Very
like you never feel like they're just like, it's all hopeful, and they're all like, they're fighting to survive, and they're fighting to keep the people that they love and treasure alive to disastrous like consequences for a lot of people, and then having to realize what that means and kind of combating what it means to die and what it means to leave people behind when they have all the power in the world, right? And that is so beautifully done. I think Freya's story, and especially her washing away like her past is beautiful, and it is like dark and horrifying, like especially where she's kind of coming to terms with a lot of the things that were done to her homeland and what she kind of sacrificed to try and protect it and how futile that sacrifice was, but then still trying to carve out hope through all of that. Just magical. Like, as that's the real Sigil magic. It's the friends we made along the way.
Yeah, I'm going to ignore that completely. I really felt that there was going to be a point where you played a Sindri when you were looking for the drop in the Overring. And I was so ready for it. It
wasn't so much fun.
Right? It wasn't a disappointment that we didn't get to play as Sindri, because ultimately that scene doesn't lead, you know, it doesn't do a lot by itself. But I like how they set up the punchline. I like the delivery of everything, you know. The ring being dropped, I felt it was masterfully done.
It's a drop near in the barrel.
Okay, moving on. Another point that I really wanted to raise was the dialogue being so powerful. And I missed this line because I was streaming. But just off the cuff, Sindri admits that Brock died. And he tried to rescue him, and he couldn't rescue a fourth of his soul or something like that. So that explains why he's blue. Like, we get an answer to a really important question, and that leads into so much, because later on, with the Draupnir ring, we take it to a mermaid who is meant to bless it with the blood of a god, and there's a really cool scene where you see the Greek Omega symbol, and it's used to embody basically the soul of Kratos, and you get a spear, Spartan spear. Brock asks the mermaid to bless the spear, and the mermaid just ignores him, and it's so heartbreaking, it's so sad. And I'm like, what happened here? Thankfully, Mimir explains that the mermaid doesn't see bodies, it sees souls, and that's why it couldn't acknowledge Brock. But then we see Kratos' growth compared to the first game. It was really beautiful. He says it needs the blessing from a brilliant swordsmith or something along those lines.
I'm off the cross.
There you go. With his most profane prayer, blesses the spear, and that was really adorable. Really, really sweet.
Like, he spends this whole like section of the game learning to kind of stop missing the forest with the trees. And then he helps Brock do the same, and it is gorgeous. Like, gorgeous. Like, talking about like Sindri just dropping, like the game kind of is completely like stacked full of these like Chekhov guns. And it was something that I initially thought was quite annoying, because I didn't know how they were going to like have enough time or like kind of have enough space to make all of these things pay off in any sort of way that could be meaningful, especially because of like how wildly kind of like important some of these things that they just drop in are. And like, it's it very much felt like a second playthrough when I was watching you play, because I had the hindsight.
Right.
And there's there's so many moments of Tyr, like Tyr, Odin, yeah. their switch off. So many moments of foreshadowing. And I originally was like, just being weird, bro. Why are you being weird? Yeah. Like, that's going to come up somewhere later on down the line, and I don't know how. And it's just like, but then you go back, and it's like,
yeah.
Oh, it's.
A lot of it makes sense, right? Mm. And I feel like I need a second playthrough to truly absorb the magnitude of what Odin was doing, because Tyr was Odin all along. And
it's me, Odin. It's me all along.
Man, it makes sense, but at the time you're just like, you're just annoying. What are you doing? Why are you being such a pacifist? You know what we're doing here. This is why we freed you. You've been held in captivity. And I feel like I realized something was up right with the Asgard thing. And I feel like you must have had a similar experience, because with the mask, all of a sudden...
He perked all up. Of a
sudden, yeah. Mm. So in case you haven't played the game yourself... As Atreus goes to help Odin, Odin wants to, he wants to find the truth. He wants to see it. He wants to learn it. But you need this mask to see it. And Atreus is going off finding fragments of the mask, building it, putting it together. I think it's eventually built, completed. And Atreus comes to the house, the safe house with Tyr and Sindri. And all of a sudden, Tyr is like, okay, well, I know a way to get to Asgard. Whereas throughout the first maybe 20, 30 hours of the game, he's been like, nope, I will not fight. No, I don't see the point in, you know, destroying Asgard and starting all this bloodshed. And I'm like, nah, this is sus. This is sus. And Brock was the only one who picked up on it. And then you get the reveal.
My heart still hurts. There is one thing you forgot to mention. The mask... if you want context, there was a Jim Carrey movie back in the I just realized, right, you don't watch movies, so that joke is I've seen the mask okay, well, if you haven't seen The Mask, watch The Mask before you play.
Wait, was there more to the joke, or was that it?
No, that was it.
I thought you were going to say something really cool then. Oh.
No, there is nothing cool about The Mask. I would find it so amazingly funny if we get whatever the follow-up to this game is with Atreus, and he puts on the mask and he's like, somebody stop me. That would be... I would be like, games are complete.
I hate that. Pack it up. I would hate that.
That's so the top of the mountain.
Did he not destroy the mask?
Yeah, they throw it in the in MacGuffin.
Yeah, because that's a really important point as well. And I mean, I guess I'll speed along a little bit. Like, all the sidekicks felt like assets in the most part. I don't like how they played against bosses, but I think in general play, I felt they played quite well. With all of them having some sort of resurrection tactic, and whether it was Sindri throwing pots or Angerboda throwing paint, I liked the creativity when it came to a player A and then the sidekick B. How did you feel about the, I guess, the sidekick system?
I definitely didn't think it was something I enjoyed in the first game, and it was, I think, mostly because it wasn't something I was very used to using. So I just kind of learned to ignore it for the most part. Yeah. This game absolutely needs you to use those sidekicks, and you can do so much, so much better if you kind of like find like the perfect balance of like letting them have some downtime to like regain arrows or pots or paint, and kind of like stacking your abilities against that. It all works together and meshes beautifully. When it works, it's like seamless, and you have like, you know, those like flowing Zen state moments where you're like wiping everything out, do like a visceral finisher, feel amazing. But then you have situational arrow moments
Oh my god, yeah.
I absolutely think like they nailed the psychics, and not just the mechanics. They nailed the approach, like, and the character development and the writing, like the writing for the side characters. They all felt like humans, like.
Mm.
I mean, yeah. Giants and Asgardians and whatnot, but like they all felt alive, you know?
Yeah.
And it was, you could clearly see what their motivations were, and it never felt like they put their motivations on the back burner. Like they never just suddenly 180 shifted to a different human being. Like the development made sense. And they continue to kind of like keep the threads alive and make sure that you remember why they are like they are. And mm-hmm. that's so important. And it's like the bit with Angraboda and Groa. It's not Groa. The grandma was the grandma's name. I'm thinking Grail, and Grail is not it. Grailer.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, Grailer. That, the wind up to that boss fight is like heart wrenching. Like, you know, when you find these animals, these soulless, like empty husks all over the place. And then you get the slow reveal to realize that it's not a monster, it's her heartbroken, grieving grandmother who's like, everything is dying and dead, and we'd be better off without being able to know how bad it is. That's wild. That's such a wild place to kind of come to. And then you go through this boss fight, and it never feels like I've slain the beast. It's like,
yeah,
grandma's still really sad. Like, it's just, that is, it's such a surprisingly heartbreaking payoff. And then you have to just sit with that. Like,
yeah,
just because you're the hero, you can't punch everything better.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, how many other AAA games will give you that as a big payoff?
Not many.
Mm.
And I agree. I actually think that's maybe the best built part of the story. From the point where you have seen these animals slain, and then you're exploring the house, and you get like a point of reference for how big this person is, and you just know you're gonna have to fight them. You just know it. It's set up perfectly. The boss fight is okay, but it's definitely a story element, especially when you defeat the boss and she's just howling these ridiculous sentiments towards Angaboda, and she's just there taking it because she knows that's not her grandmother. That is, as you said, grief. That is a grief-stricken person, and she's not been able to get over that, despite it being years ago.
I think like the most kind of like testament to how good the writing is, you meet Grayla, and you're never like, she's just a cartoon thing. You're like, I get it. Like, I get how grief could break you like that.
Yeah.
Like, how this could be your absolutely insane conclusion.
The answer lies in the heart of battle.
We might not agree with the decision, but we can at least sympathize with everything that encouraged that decision. Mm.
You can see the road to here.
Exactly. And that's where, you know, the best villains are formed, you know, where you can see their point of view. You don't have to agree with it, but if you can at least see their reasoning and see it's not just, hey, I'm strong, so I want to destroy everything. You can sympathize or empathize with them. Then that's where you have got to the top tier of storytelling. I felt like the previous game had not adjusted to making the world feel important, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So while the previous 3, 4, 5 games in Greece was very much Kratos being in the Greek world and he's just slaying everything, 2018 felt like, okay, we're in the Norse world, but the world still revolves around Kratos. Everything is happening around him, to him. He is the center focus. Whereas this game, they did a very good job of transitioning into Kratos is now just a small person in the big Norse world, and now he has to do these things, he has to follow these rules, follow these laws, cooperate with these people, and that has been replicated or mirrored in the fact that he's much more caring now, and he cares about, you know, the wildlife. He cares about Sindri. He cares about Brock. Those two, while not, you know, directly related, they definitely feed into each other and give a much more rich experience while playing the game.
Yeah, I think I've kind of talked ad nauseum about how much I enjoyed the exploration and the world itself. I love open world games, right? But a lot of open world games kind of suffer from making you feel like the world only exists as long as you're in that space.
Yeah.
Like you take over like a bandit camp, you take over like a checkpoint or whatever else, and there's action and kind of forward momentum in the story and the world and the characters themselves in that world only because you're there to observe it. And like this game feels quite opposite to that in a way that's like my favorite kind of way. Like, do you know, like in like Breath of the Wild, like you, if you walk into a space, the Bokoblins will be doing whatever they're doing.
Yeah.
You can find them just hunting or fighting or like riding their horses around that they've captured. They just go about and do what they want. And that's great. The trainers have their path that they're set. And if those two things interact, you can just walk into the middle of a beef.
Mm. Yeah,
that's great. There is no point on the map where that beef is meant to happen. It's just these are the lines, and occasionally those lines will intersect, and when they do, something will happen. That's great. That's an open world that's alive.
Yeah,
this game very much feels like it feels like a world that's dying, but because you're seeing the last embers of this world, those embers still very much alive. Like, you know, the like the you'll find ghosts, and then they'll give you like exposition about kind of why they haven't moved on, and then you get to feel the culture and you get to feel like the lives that had been around you, and then you kind of get smack dab into the middle of the decay and the dying, and you live in those spaces and kind of see how those decays and those dyings kind of change and grow and are happening in real time too. Like in, again, Vanaheim, like, you know, the where you see like, you know, the rot and like the, I can't remember what those things are called, like they're the big orbs, and there's like, you know, the dying animals. Like there's all these things that are there and they exist regardless of you being there to interact with them.
Right.
And you have the choice to do so, and they will have consequences in other ways. In the same way with the dragon is just there. It's going to be there if you're not there or not. And if you turn up, it's going to feel some sort of way about that. That's great. Yeah. that's super fun.
I feel like a lot of the aspects advanced the story or the characters. I feel like the only one bit that maybe didn't was when Kratos met the Norns. And I feel that was very much because the Norns were annoying. They were antagonistic, but then we got very close to seeing old Kratos back, the Greek side, the arrogant side that wasn't listening or trying to hear out anything, because they were outright telling him what was going to happen. And he was just like, no. That made me feel like Kratos was going to die.
But
that wasn't the swerve. The swerve was he lived to see another day. I don't know how you felt about the Norn sequence.
I really, really, really like when a character or like a archetype will kind of be like this immovable thing, and it challenges everything that we have like kind of worked with up until that point. Because like, again, big strong hero, we're gonna punch things better, right? That's the aim. That's the the gross simplification of the hero's journey, right? We're gonna punch things better. But then you have like institutions like Norns where it's like, you can't really punch us. You can't really like, you can squirm and you can do what you want, but this is what it is. And then it challenges the player and us with our agency to kind of be like, I can't punch that. So I have to think and I have to challenge myself, and I have to literally have a moment of like self-realization. And that's That's so cool. And it should be annoying and it should be challenging and it should be something that's frustrating. And it delivers on all of those things. It's great. Like, it's because, like, if something's annoying and it's not meant to be annoying, that's bad. If something is annoying and it makes you stop and think and constantly kind of have that working in you, that's fantastic. Because that was not just by design, it nailed and thrived in that design. Mm. That's great. Mm. Like,
I mean, all in all, I think it was a great game that expanded upon the story. I have my qualms in the story aspect.
It was
I guess even further than that, there was a lot of questions that I felt that weren't answered. Some of them were, like, how he got to there in the first place. I was expecting a more exciting answer, but I guess it is what it is. But with several other questions, like with how Atreus was falling ill and someone blew the horn, it felt like that was meant to be answered in this game. I guess we got an answer to what was on the other side of the white light in Alfheim. But yeah, I feel like there were questions that needed answering that we didn't get answers to. And like, that is hard to do when you make a trilogy into two games. But yeah, I feel like we kind of missed out story-wise.
I want my want is always more, especially in worlds and kind of games and stories that I really love. I feel like they did an excellent job with the time and the space that they had. Because, like, remember, like, these games have been like, what, like, how long have they been as a development cycle?
Yeah. Very long time.
they take a lot of time, and it's and that's a lot to kind of say to someone, like, because I want more, you're gonna have to dedicate like a decade of your life to to satisfy that. Like, and people creatively want to make other things, and that's fine, and I want to respect that.
Yeah.
I want more of this. And like, if people kind of want to make this thing and kind of like condense this thing and do it, this is the best way they could have done it. Like, is there questions? Yeah. Like, are there certain things that I feel like could have been fleshed out deeper? Yeah, absolutely. But were the things they did good, and did they serve the plot and the pace and the gameplay and your expectations well? 100% yes. Like, 100% yes. I adore this game. It's not flawless, but the good far outweighs the bad.
100%. Yeah, I mean, let's not kid ourselves. This is an excellent game. I wouldn't say it's a perfect game, but there's a reason why it was Ragnarok, Elden Ring. Mm-hmm. Right? You know, those two games dominated the year, and Ragnarok sold so many units despite it being released mid-November. That goes to show the appetite was there, the quality was there. They really outdid themselves. Now,
they really outdid themselves.
Now, what rating are you going to give this game?
9 out of 10. A very, very, very strong 9 out of 10. This is not just one of the best sequels of all time. This is one of the best games of all time. This is an absolute masterpiece. Insofar as like how they use cinematography, how they use sound, like, we didn't even get a chance to talk about the music. The music in this game is a whole mechanic, and it is a whole emotionally lifting and moving majesty of a soundtrack. It's so good. Bear McCreary. He deserves double the amount of awards that he was winning. He smashed it. He absolutely smashed it.
Honestly, I feel like we could have an entire podcast on the music alone. I think it's the best complete soundtrack in gaming that I've heard. So good. Svartalfheim has no right to be that good. It's
made that's great.
Man, it's made its way into my gym playlist. It's so iconic. I love that song. But I would agree with your rating. 9 out of 10 is the way I'd go. If I did do like decimals and all of that, I'd give it a 9.5 probably. But I don't like to do that. I like to go, it's either a 10 or it's a 9, and I can't give it a 10. There are just certain things that don't, that prevent me from giving it a perfect rating, but it's as good as, it's a pretty damn, you know, a very good achievement for everyone in Santa Monica. I know Corey Barlow didn't direct, but he was very hands-on. He and Eric Williams did a very good job, and I hope all of them are proud of themselves because they smashed it. Very good game. And as you said, the music is amazing. I don't know what more we can say about the music, but yeah, as Maltifime is one of the best songs of all time, not even, you know, gaming OSTs for me.
There are, I, do you know what, man, like I tend to be like certain like composers, when I see their name on like a game, I'm way more excited because like, I think we could do like a whole podcast about kind of like how important soundtracks are in gaming to your immersion and your like understanding of the space, because like there's so much emotional heavy lifting and also kind of cues that music give you to feel about things. And this game, there's like even the moments where you stop noticing it, and that's also a sign of a good soundtrack, when it can make you feel without intrinsically just noticing that it's there. It just it swells and kind of like takes you across in this journey that you're going with the characters. Seems the moments, like, you know, when Kratos just kind of like has to sit in a moment and be like, oh god, like and the music is just, I, when it's like silent and it's slowly building and you feel your heart swelling or like the bottom of your stomach drop out, amazing. Powerful. Amazing.
Powerful. Yeah, you're right. We could go on for another hour and a half on this, but yeah, we definitely have to call time on this. If you're watching this on YouTube, please give us a thumbs up, subscribe, and leave a comment as to what you score God of War Ragnarok out of 10. We have videos on our Spotify now, so you can watch us on Spotify to download us. You don't have to worry about, you know, locking your phone. Streamcast _ on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. We are youtube.com/streamcast and twitch.tv/streamcast TV, where you can watch us stream every weekday. You'll see Hassan Tuesdays and Thursdays. You'll see us Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays from 9 p.m. UK time. Our website, thestreamcast.co.uk, is where you can go to read our blogs, find out where we've got events coming up, and just anything else that you want to check out about us is probably on that platform. But until next time, take care of yourselves and your loved ones. Stay safe. We'll see you on the next Streamcast.